Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. Many people have an appetite for films and television shows about organized crime. Whether it be The Godfather, The Sopranos, Goodfellas, or Scarface, the public's fascination with the mafia never ends. My guest today, however, is not a fictionalized character on screen. He's not Tony Soprano or Don Corleone, but a real-life mafioso who, by his own admission, committed countless atrocities. Sammy the Bull Gravano had a long and notorious career in La Cosa Nostra, the Brooklyn-based Sicilian crime family where he served as underboss to the infamous John Gotti. Yet the man who once upheld the mafia code of silence, or omerta, turned state's evidence against his own, sending Gotti and many others to prison. And now Gravano is talking, and talking and talking, on several social media platforms. I recently found that he has a podcast entitled Our Thing, detailing the exploits of his career. In its 5 seasons, Our Thing tells stories from Gravano's early days as a teenage gangster to how he methodically plans a killing. The stories are both disturbing and captivating. During my conversation with him, I had to remind myself that Gravano is the real thing. But first, a conversation with the man who convinced Gravano to record the podcast. Director, producer, cinematographer, and editor, James Carroll has worked on hit reality shows like Undercover Boss and gritty documentaries about police corruption and a serial killer. He once was embedded with drug lords in the Dominican Republic while filming a documentary. Despite Carroll's credentials working with dangerous subjects, sitting in a studio alongside a known assassin is still a perilous challenge. I wanted to know how he first came to work with Sammy the Bull Gravano.
So I'm repped at WME.
Right.
And one day I get a call and there's this production company that has secured Sammy the Bull. And they were like, we want you to meet Sammy at our boardroom in Beverly Hills at WME. And I said, great. Now, just so you know, I knew who Sammy the Bull was. And my mom is Italian. My grandfather was, you know, Italian. But, you know, I'm half Italian. I knew what Sammy was, but I never really knew who he was. So I go into the meeting, and I do this with everyone that I meet. I don't want to know anything about you. I really don't read about you. I don't want to research you. I don't want to know really anything about you, because what I want to do is when I meet you, I want to experience that just you and me. So I go in there and there's, you know, agents and the production companies in there, and he's sitting right across from me. And I'm a big guy. I'm like 6'2". And I, you know, I shake his hand and we sit down. And he looks at me and he's like, and I could tell he's, you know, I've been around killers at this point. The intensity I'm gravitated to and I'm comfortable with. And he says, tell me about yourself. So I start telling him, you know, about myself.
Yeah. He does to you what you normally do to other people, but go ahead.
Exactly. So I'm in the hot seat and I play along and I mentioned that my mom's Italian. And at the end, he's like, is your dad Italian? And I said, no. And he's like, well, then you're not fucking Italian, are you? And I look at him and I said, I never said I was fucking Italian, did I, Sammy? And at that moment, I think there was this connection where we instantly bonded at that sit down.
He was testing you.
He was. And he knew that what I know, I know. And what I don't know, I don't know. And I'm totally comfortable with that, you know, and that freaks people out sometimes.
Right.
But like that's just me. And we got up from that meeting. We walked around. Beverly Hills, you know, we just hit it off. And that was 2017 or 2018. It was a long time ago.
The concept of the meeting going in was he wanted to do a podcast or he didn't know. He wanted to do a documentary. What did he want?
So the production company was trying to sell his story as a documentary for television. Right. And they wanted me to be a director on it. I was interested. They wanted me, you know, whatever. Now, it gets to the point where the production company sends me over to Arizona alone right. to hang out with him.
Right.
I go over. I actually drive over because I was like, you know, I don't really want to be there. I want to have my own car. And I show up to his house. I walk right in. I sit down in his family room. And for the next 3 days, I have got, you know, I've got a notebook behind me somewhere. I'm just writing
and no recording.
His story.
No recording.
No. No, I want to experience it. I want to feel it. I want to put it up in my head and write it out. So I'm like, you know, he tells me a tremendous amount, which, by the way, again, did not research, did not read, did not know a lot about the mafia, you know, just knew the headlines, whatever. But I wanted to experience what it was like for him. So I'm writing all this. I'm like starring all this. And I'm like, this is unbelievable. Like, I'm sitting next to a guy who was at the table, pretty much every single table. And I love that. I love anyone who was there. I gravitate to people like that. I gravitate to characters like that. So I'm all in on this guy. And he reminds me of my grandfather. And we develop a friendship, really. All of this happens throughout a year. It's a documentary. No, it's not a documentary. We're not going to buy it. Oh, it's a podcast. Okay, well, it's a podcast here. Okay, it's a podcast over there. You know, what is it? And then COVID hits.
Right.
And so finally, it ends up with Sammy calling me, not connected to anyone at this point, solo, because they couldn't sell and nothing happened. And he's like, hey, do you want to do a podcast with me? And I said, sure. Like, I'd love that, you know? I have no problem with that.
Why do you think he wanted to do that, other than beyond money?
There are two things that are in play here. One, he's labeled something. He has been labeled something since 1990. And, you know, I've met enough people and heard enough stories at this point in my life and career that when I meet him, I know the label, right? The label is a rat. Yeah. You're a rat. You know,
okay.
And I start to kind of dig and try to understand this individual who you just asked the question that I asked at the very beginning when I sat down with him, you know, how could you do this? And it took me a year to realize and figure out why.
Why?
The relationship that he had with Cosa Nostra.
And with John.
And with John. Turned in 1990 when they were locked up, when they were extracted from their club, the Ravenite, and taken to jail and stuck in this prison for 1 year. Tapes started to come out, and Gotti, the relationship really, really took a turn for the worse. And, you know, Sammy was hurt by that. And all of a sudden, the tapes come out. Gotti is on the tapes. There's a lot of stuff that's happening behind the scenes with, you know, their relationship within prison. And then he says in the podcast, I believe in episode one, and you know, we're going into season five now. So I believe it was repeated in late in season four. But he said, if it comes down to this, if this is what Cosa Nostra is by 1990, and he's already lived such a life in it, if this is what it comes down to, the backstabbing, the lying, the cheating, the craziness of John Gotti, well, then fuck it. I don't want to be a part of this right. life anymore.
What was it that would appeal to you about the audio-only project?
I started in radio. So,
oh, really?
I think that's not really out there. But when I was 13, I was obsessed with radio for some reason. This was in the mid-90s. So, you know, before the cell phone, the social, the internet. And I remember telling my parents, I was like, you know, I really want to work at a radio station. And they were like, there's absolutely no way you're going to work at a radio station. Like, you're, you know, you're a kid. That doesn't happen until later. And I really stalked this one night show DJ. You know, I just called him and called him and called him, you know, in a way that was like weird, but also endearing because I was, you know, a kid. And I finally got my way into the station. Like I was like, let me just sit in with you one day. So I like was wow. sitting there watching him do the whole night show thing. And I was like, this is my life. Like, I love this. And I really didn't want to be on the radio. I wanted to do everything behind the scenes. I was like interested in programming music. I was interested in how it all worked. And I got a summer internship when I was 15. So a couple years later. And I remember the day that my summer internship was over, I went to the GM's office. I like literally just barged right in. And I said, I can't leave here. Like, I, there's no way that I can leave here. You just have me dust something. Like, I don't pay me. I have to, like, be here. I have to be a part of this.
Where were you living then?
I grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida. I was born and raised in St. Pete, Florida. So this right. was, you know, the mid-90s. This was, you know, a hot AC station. So we were, like, playing Phil Collins and Steve Winwood and all of that stuff. And he was like, great. And what ended up happening was I started to really go there Monday through Friday and really work there. And I was homeschooled through high school. So it kind of helped out with the, you know, the scheduling. And I was fascinated by what happened when they turned off the microphone. So I picked up a video camera, not knowing anything about, I mean, just nothing. Like I was like, let me just get a video camera. Let me just start filming these personalities, because I was obsessed with characters and their stories. And what happened when they turned off the mic was like crazy.
In what way?
Well, they were just different, you know, very much robotic on, you know, a script was in front of you and they were like, this is the weather and blah, blah, blah. You know how they are. Mm-hmm. And when they turned off the microphone, they became authentic. And I craved authenticity. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted that more than anything. So I pitched a radio station down there, an idea. I was like, listen, I got a camera. I don't know anything, but let me go in there and let me start filming you guys. And what I did was this was early 2000s. So this was before YouTube. This was before, you know, a lot of the stuff. And I would film hours and hours and hours of these radio personalities off the air. I would go home with them. I would go to events with them.
Now they're really regretting taking that kid's phone call.
Yeah.
You're taking a shower and you're like, what are you doing? Hey, what are you doing in there?
Let me get in there. Let me get that shot. So I started cutting it together. We put together a monthly video that was like 7 to 10 minutes long. And we uploaded it every month on the website. And it became like, you know, it was written up in Billboard. It was in the New York Times. And that's what landed me out in Los Angeles. That's what kind of propelled me out here. And when I landed out here, they were like, what do you want to do? And this production company. And I was like, oh, I'm a director, you know? And they were like, what? You're not a director. And I'm like, I'm not. And they're like, no, you've got to like start as a PA.
Yeah. You're Jimmy Olsen.
Right. So
you're not Superman. Like, you're Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah. So I did not go into production. Weirdly enough, I was like, well, I don't want to be a PA. Like, what else do you have? And they were like, right. Well, you can digitize tapes at night. So I was like, okay, that sounds good. So I worked overnights digitizing tapes for 3 months. And I literally was like, this is the worst decision I've ever made. I don't know what I'm doing. And I went to the owner and walked right in again. And I sat in front of him and I was like, listen, I can't do this. You got to give me something creative or else I got to leave. And they were like, well, you got to cut a sizzle. And I was like, well, what's that? You know, and I cut a sizzle that turned into a pilot, which turned into two series of television on A&E. And that's kind of what got my start as an editor first.
Which were they?
So that was a show called Obsessed, which is all about OCD. And what we did was we followed the cognitive behavioral therapy of an individual throughout the course of like 16 weeks. And again, it was, you know, authentic. And I really enjoyed that. I loved dealing with real people. I'm so happy and fortunate that I got to do that instead of some reality show, which was not what I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning of your career, is that a part of it? You enlisting people to talk, is that a skill you developed?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a lot, you know, remember, there's a lot going on behind the scenes when I do these projects. There's a lot happening, as you know. There's a lot of development happening. There's a lot of relationship building. There's a lot of projects that are started that are never completed because they're not financed. So I'm being put into situations where the production companies will say, hey, go take a camera and go out there and film this guy. And I'm like, well, who is he? And he's like, well, he's a convicted killer. And I drive out by myself. And, you know, there was this one time where I was in the middle of California and it was a slaughterhouse. Literally, they were killing cows. And there's this, you know, massive dude. And he's sitting in this shack. And I go in and there's a guy on the sofa. And I'm sure these guys are armed, right? But I've got a camera, you know? And that disarms everyone.
Everybody calms down.
Well, they want me there because for some reason, these guys, they love when I'm there and I listen to them. Because right. It's more than just me with the camera. It's, I actually am interested and I care about your story.
Right.
In a very human way. I'm not trying to get in there and get all the crazy stuff. I'm actually trying to figure you out.
Tell me your story.
Exactly. And I care. And they see that. You know, they realize that. And I go in there and no one's there with me. I really roll a lot by myself. So I set up the camera, I set up the mic, and this dude's sitting in, you know, a plastic chair in the middle of this abandoned shack. And I start asking him questions. And I'm like, so what's going on, man? Like, where are we, first of all, you know? And this is by design. Halfway through the interview, you know, they start actually killing. And you hear the screams.
Of the cattle.
Yeah, and the intimidation sets in. And you're like, oh, okay, this is with intention, and this is an intimidation. In that moment, I'm like, okay, I got a little baby at home. You know, I have a wife, and I'm here all alone, and you just commit to it.
Yeah.
And you try not to show any fear because at the end of the day, like I said, I'm here to listen to your story.
Our Thing creator and producer, James Carroll. If you love conversations with creative minds, be sure to check out my episode with radio and podcast producer, Ira Glass.
I mean, this show reflects my taste, but also I have to say the taste of my coworkers. You know, like, it's not just mine at this point. Like, it's something that we all share, and I happen to be the front man. In that way, it's different than it was from the beginning. Like, I am the front man for this thing that we make together, like somebody who's in a band that's been playing for a long time.
Hear more of my conversation with Ira Glass at heresthething.org. After the break, James Carroll shares the way the Our Thing podcast is a form of therapy for Gravano. And later in the program, my talk with Sammy Gravano about what it was like working with the Gambino crime family boss, John Gotti.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
It took 11 years to get to this sale. The Knix Anniversary Sale is on now at knix.com. Celebrate the intimate apparel company that has reinvented products for real life with one of Knix's biggest sales of the year. Get 30% off all leak-proof apparel from the number one leak-proof brand in North America, including period underwear, swimwear, activewear, and more. Millions of people have made the switch to Knix leak-proof underwear, and there's never been a better time for you to try. Save 30% on super comfortable, machine washable, and great-looking underwear that's perfect for periods and light bladder leaks. Choose from a variety of colors, styles, and sizes, from extra small to 4XL. You can even match your leak-proof underwear with an incredibly supportive and comfortable Knix wireless bra. Don't miss this chance to stock up on your Knix favorites or try something new. It only happens once a year at Knix.com. That's KNIX.com for the Knix Anniversary Sale. Hurry, the sale ends on Monday, May 13th. Go to Knix.com. That's KNIX.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. James Carroll has worked with Sammy the Bull Gravano for 5 seasons on the Our Thing podcast. I wanted to know, in all of their time working together, if Gravano had expressed any signs of remorse.
I've asked that question, and we've talked about that privately.
What did he say?
I don't think he has remorse. It's very much like the question I asked him when the first time, this was the first time I asked him and the only time I asked him, you know, he was telling me about a gunfight that he was in. And I was like, were you scared? And he looks at me and he's like, that's a really dumb question. And to you and I, you know, that's a serious question. I'm scared because of whatever. And he said, you got to realize I've done this my entire life. I'm not scared. It'd be like you going into your car and driving. Are you scared when you drive? Right. So to ask that question to him, you know, are you remorseful? Or do you look back? I think he was extremely calculated. I think he made those decisions. I don't believe he makes emotional decisions.
I just was wondering if, because there's something about him. Do you think you function for people like this, and this is maybe a tired question, as somewhat of a therapist? Are these sessions therapy for him?
Oh, I think so. He's emoted in front of me, you know, on camera. And again, for some reason, I've been gifted an ability to be around individuals and for them to be extremely comfortable. So it's very much a perfect union when that happens. His love for Cosa Nostra is the real deal love. Like, this dude loved Cosa Nostra.
When it worked.
All the way up to the end. I think there was a lot going on in like the late 80s, and John Gotti was very, very difficult as a boss. And he really turned the mafia into something that they were not used to. But the old, and this is what I love about these stories, the old days. The original, like, early days of Sammy the Bull in the 60s and early 70s, where he was around the gangsters of the 40s and 50s that were like, that was their heyday. Those are incredible stories, and the relationships.
The very thing you were there for and that you did, when that was taken away, what was the point in that? It was the protection of that group. With us, we take care of each other. We're safe. Mm-hmm. No one's ever going to hurt you. It's like NATO. Anybody that attacks you, attacks us. Anybody that's your enemy is our enemy. We have your back. And in this life with us, we are going to take care of you. Don't you worry. No one's going to fuck with you or your family, blah, 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 blah. And the minute that went away, the minute you couldn't rely on that, what's the point? What's the point? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Is he still in any danger?
I don't think so, no. I mean, listen, he drives me around.
You're an idiot.
In Phoenix. So you're going to love this story. So it's one of the first times I'm over there. He drives, you know, a very four-door, small, compact car. Okay. Right. This isn't a Lincoln or a Mercedes or whatever. Yeah. So we hop in and he's like, you hungry? And I'm like, yeah, I'm hungry. He's like, oh, we're going to go to P.F. Chang's. So we drive and, you know, Arizona, Phoenix area, there's, you know, obviously a lot of road, you know, a lot of lanes. And real quickly, I understand what's going on. You know, this is a man who usually was driven around, has spent a tremendous amount of time in isolation. And, you know, he was about a year and a half out at that point when I first met him. And, you know, we're a little bit all over the place. We go to P.F. Chang's. We sit down. He starts telling me about, you know, hits and everything. And I'm like looking over and there's this, you know, poor woman who's trying to eat her spicy chicken. And she's hearing this crazy story and, she, you know, she can't believe it. And I can't believe that I'm sitting here with Sammy the Bull who has the glasses on and whatever. So we get back in the car and he rolls down the window and he lights a cigarette and we drive away and we stop at this stop sign and there's this bicyclist coming up and I see the bicyclist and I'm like, oh God, you know, here we go, right? And this is early on in my relationship, so I don't really have the back and forth that I would have with him now. So he starts to go and then the bicyclist, whoa, you know, and he slams on his brakes and the bicyclist turns around and I mean, the guy had no clue who he was dealing with.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, fuck you, man. You know, whatever, whatever. And Sammy's like, fuck me, fuck you, you know, and really just starts to scream at him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit, like, fuck, man, I'm going to be involved in, I don't know what's going to happen.
He's going to
get out and beat him. Yeah, he's going to run over him. I don't know what's happening.
Right.
So the guy drives away and he won't let it go.
Yeah.
Right. He's talking about it that night. He's talking about it the next day. And to this day, we still talk about the guy and the bicyclist.
My last question for you is, there's more square mileage here for you to explore with him. You're doing another season, or are you kind of, is it winding down in terms of what he has to offer?
With me, I think it's winding down. I'm still a part of it. I still help him. Really, no one else touched the project except Sammy and myself. It's very rare that this happens, and you know this. It's like usually there's producers weighing in and whoever is the money person. And
sure.
Like, but it was just really just Sammy and I. I would send the cuts to Sammy, and Sammy's extremely smart when it comes to like storytelling, when it comes to what's good and what's not. He has taste, which I believe that you can't be taught. You have to be born with. So I believe that now there's new things that he's going to be doing, and I think it's exciting for him, and I'm excited for him. But I think for me, I ran, you know, the mileage. I got the information. I'm very happy with how the podcast turned out.
What have you learned? What'd you learn from him?
You know, I love to romanticize about things. I love that. You know, I sit there and I think about things and I think, oh, this is the type of person he is. Or this is what I want to do with him. You know, I
want one of the knights of the round table.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I just romanticize about it. And I think because I'm putting it through my filter, which is like I'm a certain way and I'm very, you know, I love emotion and I love depth and I love authenticity. And when I first started the project, I was like, oh, I'm going to get in there and I'm going to get what's there. But I found out that there's nothing there. And that's okay. Huh. That's the type of person he is. And people are that way. There are people out there that are that way.
He's that type of creature.
He is. And, you know, at the end of the day, I have spent, what, 4 or 5 years with him now. We talk on the phone. You know, he calls me up. We have personal conversations. I know his family. He knows my family. So, you know, there's that. But at the end of the day, he is that person, and that's it, period.
Yeah. Man, this podcast, we couldn't stop listening. We couldn't believe it. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you, Alec. Thank you very much.
Our Thing creator, James Carroll. Sammy Gravano was convicted for his participation in 19 murders, including his role in the 1985 hit on the then head of the Gambino crime family, Paul Castellano. Gravano worked as underboss to John Gotti before serving time alongside Gotti in prison until he cut a plea deal. He testified as a government witness against Gotti and 30 other mobsters. Gravano was released early and entered the witness protection program, which he left after less than a year. It seems the pull of a life of crime was inescapable as Gravano returned to prison in 2000 for running an ecstasy drug ring. He was released in 2017 and started telling his story on the Our Thing podcast just a few years later. Gravano grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, born to Sicilian immigrants. Since he was still a teenager when he entered the life, I was curious to learn about his relationship with his parents and what they knew about his activities.
I was in my 30s. I was only a maid guy. They never knew that. But they were hardworking people. They worked 10, 12 hours a day. My mother was a seamstress. My right. father was a painter. And then they opened up a small little dress factory, and he went in, worked with her, and they worked hard their whole life. They didn't have a lot of money, but whatever they had, it was always shared with the family, a dinner or this or that or the other thing. They bought a small little house in Lake Ronkonkoma in Long Island, and it was always all the uncles and cousins and everybody there.
Back when that was the boondocks.
Yeah, but that was definitely the boondocks.
Quiet out there then.
Yeah, now it's probably all crowded. But yeah. So they were like that. They were great, legitimate people. I mean, but I was always in trouble. I was always the black sheep. But by the time I went into the military, I was 19. I got drafted during the Vietnam War. They had retired and moved to Long Island. Then they moved back into Staten Island. They passed away in living in Staten Island. But I wish I could have spent a lot more time with my father, going just simple things, going to a baseball game or something like that. We'll go fishing. He was originally in Italy, he was a fisherman. So going fishing with him was, you know, like a big thing. And I really didn't give them any money. I didn't have anything while they were, you know, working until they got very old. Then I took care of them as best as I could, but they didn't need it. They had their retirement money. Very small appetite to do anything. They were up in age, they were sickly. But I was always there to take care of them, connections with doctors, whatever I could possibly do. They never asked me where I got money or did anything, because I really, when they were alive, I didn't have big money. Big money started flowing, you know, during their real old age, sick,
right.
and passed away.
Right.
I was in 3 mafia wars. And I planned and plotted in 2 of them. I started off in the Colombo family. There was 2 parts to it. The Profaci and the Gallos. Everybody went to prison. It stopped. When Crazy Joe Gallo came out, the second part started. I was already with the Colombo people. I did already work, meaning a murder. I was eventually transferred over to the Gambino family. And in the Gambino family, when Angelo Bruno was killed in Philadelphia, there was a war broke out.
I listened to the story on the podcast.
Yeah.
The guy you took out to the golf club.
Yes, Johnny Keyes. Right. So they couldn't, 5 families and the Philadelphia family couldn't kill him. And I wound up getting the hit, and I wound up killing them. It was a commissioned hit. It's at the highest level. And then I controlled the whole Castellano hit. I did the planning and the plotting, and I was on the hit. John Gotti was in the car next to me. He was my driver. I had the walkie-talkie, and I controlled 11 people who were on the hit.
Now, Johnny Keyes, in the podcast, you tell that story. He was old school, and he was like teaching you in the car to do the hit, not get caught. You felt this admiration for him, and you thought he was this great old school guy.
Right.
But at the same time, he did the hit without the approval of the commission, correct? You were ordered to kill him because he broke the rules, correct?
Well, he didn't actually do the hit, I mean, on Angelo Bruno.
Right.
That was all bullshit. He was actually Angelo Bruno's cousin. He was fighting the other side. I mean, we really, it was their problem, their thing. And you know what, like you said, he was, you know, telling me how to do the hit on himself. And I came to learn, now that I'm writing, is that we were like two samurais. We were both hit guys. He was a lot better, older, smarter, wiser than me. And we met on the battlefield. And what happened is when he was in that van, he knew he lost. He knew I did something that the whole six families couldn't do. And he had a respect for me. And he actually was educating me and teaching me Cosa Nostra, knowing he was going to die. But if you know about samurais, when they lose, they want to die. But they want to die in an honorable way, whether they
put my shoes off.
Yes. Well, with him, it was his shoes off. He was sending a message to his wife. Who would do that at 70 years old? I mean, he blew me away with things he wanted. But I understood it later on when it was explained. I became Cosa Nostra mostly because of him in a way that I wasn't before. So the door to my life closed on that hit.
You went to prison twice or three times?
I went lengthy times. I went a bunch of times, but I went in 1990. I got a 5-year bit, the thing with John Gotti, and I cooperated. The second time I went to prison, I got a 20-year bit. I did almost 18 years straight.
So you do 18 years?
Straight.
And you'd already testified?
Yeah.
You'd already left witness protection, correct?
Yeah, I was only in the witness protection for 8 months.
Why did you want to get out of witness protection?
Well, I wanted no part of it. I had money. When I got out of prison, I wanted no part of the witness protection program. You had to change your name and do things and live by certain rules. I did my time. I didn't need their help. I didn't need their money. But they wanted me bad. They said, Sammy, you got 19 murders. You got sentenced to 5 years. The government did the right thing with you. You're going to make them look like horseshit if you don't come in. Give them some more time. Volunteer for this program. They could pound their chest a little bit. I felt that they did treat me right, and I did a 5-year sentence. I should have did a hell of a lot more than that. So I agreed to do 1 year and 1 year only. And that's what I did. And I stayed in the program. Some woman recognized me. They wanted me to start over. I wouldn't do it. So in 8 months, I said, I promise you 1 year, I'm not starting over. And they said, you have to. And I said, well, I'm not gonna. And they said, well, then you'd have to sign out. And I said, then I'm gonna sign out. I promise you, I'm in 8 months. I promise you a year, 4 more months I'll give you. And if you don't accept that, then I quit. I'm out. And I quit, I was out. And I went to Arizona where my family was.
And you weren't afraid?
No.
You're out of witness protection. You're viewed as somebody that turned on John. So when you go to prison for the ecstasy charges, is that probably one of the most nerve-wracking times of your life? Because I would imagine, were you afraid they were going to get you when you were in prison?
I thought they would. I mean, I'm coming in with a lot of baggage. I had a 20-year sentence. That's where all these tattoos came from. What I did is I tattooed up and I said, as soon as somebody fucks with me, I'm going to kill him in prison. I thought I'd never get out of prison and I would probably die in prison. So I said, I got nothing to lose. And that's what I'm going to do. I tattooed up. I put my prison hat on and I said, the first person who fucks with me, I'm going to kill. And that's going to push people away thinking about coming over to me or fucking with me. But it really never happened.
You're doing this work, and the whole time you're doing this work, there's a whole layer of society that's out to get you. Was there a part of you that you understood that? You didn't begrudge them that they had a job to do. Did you kind of recognize that and say, hey, these guys, you know, we're breaking the law and they got to do what they got to do? Or did you think all of them were the enemy?
No. Yeah, listen, I dealt with a lot of agents on a constant basis. I got to know their names and who they were. I saw them every day watching. And they were legit. In other words, they had a job. And I didn't, to catch us, we had a job is to get away. And as long as they told the truth, I don't begrudge them. It's people who lied about people, made up lies, and did all kinds of bullshit that I hated them. But after I cooperated, I got to know them. I actually lived with them for years. I was in Quantico, a military base, for months and months and months. I lived with them every day of the week. And I got to know a lot of them. I got to trust them.
Like Frankie Pentangeli.
Yes.
Now, beyond the ones that were handling you, if you will, when you testified and so forth, during your career, when you're out and you're younger, when you're a made guy, and there's a lot of money on the line, I would assume you wanted the cops to cooperate with you, or there were times when it would be helpful if the cops cooperated with you. And you didn't want to get that wrong, meaning you didn't want to go after a guy and make a play on a cop or somebody, and you didn't know if he was going to cooperate with you. Meaning, was there a tell? Was there a tell you would see that would tell you that a cop was ready to come over and he was dirty and he would cooperate with you?
Yeah. I mean, it became obvious. You kind of distinguished the difference. Like this guy, Frank and Matty, they used to call them the twins. You saw one, you saw the other. I saw them all the time. One time, Christmas time, I came to my office and my secretary was there. It was snowing, it was cold. And she said that Frank and Matty are out there watching. She even knew their name. We knew their names and everything. So I said, how long were they out there? She said, quite a while. So I got a box, cardboard box. I got some coffee, I got cookies, all kinds of cannolis, everything. And I put a box full of stuff. I went out, I walked to the car in the snow, knocked on the window, and said, bro, you guys don't ever go home? And said, this is our job. I said, here's a box of cookies and coffee and stuff like that. So they said, no, we can't take that. I said, listen, it's not a bribe. It's cookies, bro. I know you're not going to do nothing for. So take the fucking cookies. They took the cookies. And when I flipped, those are the guys I actually flipped with.
Now, John Gotti, did you think he was a good boss ever?
No, he wasn't a good boss. He's not an actor. We're not actors. We're gangsters. It's a secret society and a brotherhood. Let me give you a little Carlo Gambino. When he came in a room, in a restaurant, all you did was look eye to eye and give a slight nod of the head, and that's your saying hello. You don't go give him a bottle of champagne. You don't wave, hey, Carlo. We don't do that. So what he did is he exposed all of Cosa Nostra. When I cooperated, I was living with the government. The government loved him. What he did was gave up the whole mafia on a silver platter, on his ego. He was a narcissist who put on this show.
He bought into the whole Dapper Don thing.
Without a doubt. If he knew what reporter was going to say, call him the Dapper Don, the reporter could have called him up and said, listen, I'm going to do an article. I'm going to call you the Dapper Don. He would have got $100,000.
Who did you think was good? Who's someone else in organized crime that you really admired?
Frankie DiCicco. He was like a big brother to me. And when John and his crew were in trouble for dealing drugs, they were going to get taken out. They came to me and Frankie DiCicco and a guy named Joe Piney, a few people, for help to be in this war. Without us, he doesn't live. When I talked to Frankie DiCicco about it, I didn't want to be in that war. And I told Frankie, well, if we're going to be in it, I want you to be the boss. He said, I could be his underboss. He can't be mine. He's got an ego like the Empire State Building. We'll have nothing but trouble. We'll take over. Let him be the boss. We'll be the power behind the throne. If he doesn't act right, I give you my word, we'll kill him. I'll be the boss, you'll be my underboss. I said yes. Now, I'm going to give you an example of Frankie DiCicco, what I think of him. John had a powerful crew, no question. I had a powerful crew, no question. If you put our two crews together, we weren't a pimple on Frankie DiCicco's ass. That was the real power. His whole family, women in the family, I think if you kill somebody in front of them, they'll help you move the body. So this was the real deal. His father, his uncles were made, everybody, his whole family. And people loved him. So this was the real power. He's the guy who got blown up 4 months after the hit.
Did you ever get the impression that John's son, that John Jr., was going to try to do something to you? That he was out there trying to find you?
While John was alive, I knew he would send a team down. Again, I'm a professional hit guy of mega proportions. And I waited for that team. I was armed every single day. I lived in an area and a spot that I always had the advantage. I always knew exactly what I was doing, where I was going to sit, and I was always armed. When I got pinched for the ecstasy in my house, I had 4 guns hidden, all of them loaded, 1 shotgun and 3 pistols, and a .357 Magnum by my side while I slept. I waited for them to come. I knew John would send them. They did. They found me. They sat on me for months and months and months, and they always felt like they would never be in the proper position. And one guy, Huck, who was in my crew, made guy, said, I'll guarantee you Sammy's going to have a gun. I guarantee you he won't run. And I'll guarantee you he's going to try and kill us. And he was 1,000% right. But before they had a chance to make the move, they sat on me for months and were afraid to make the move. I got pinched for ecstasy, and I went to prison, and that was over. So I didn't underestimate that John would send somebody. He talked to his brother, Pete, who became the boss, a complete fucking moron. And he gave Huck and a few guys the hit, and he botched the whole thing. He didn't send the right guys.
Sammy the Bull Gravano. If you're enjoying this conversation, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend and follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Sammy the Bull shares why he was the hitman the bosses relied on.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
It took 11 years to get to this sale. The Knicks anniversary sale is on now at knix.com. Celebrate the intimate apparel company that has reinvented products for real life with one of Knicks' biggest sales of the year. Get 30% off all leak-proof apparel from the number one leak-proof brand in North America, including period underwear, swimwear, activewear, and more. Millions of people have made the switch to Knicks leak-proof underwear, and there's never been a better time for you to try. Save 30% on super comfortable, machine-washable, and great-looking underwear that's perfect for periods and light bladder leaks. Choose from a variety of colors, styles, and sizes, from extra small to 4XL. You can even match your leak-proof underwear with an incredibly supportive and comfortable Knicks wireless bra. Don't miss this chance to stock up on your Knicks favorites or try something new. It only happens once a year at Knicks.com. That's KNIX.com for the Knicks anniversary sale. Hurry, the sale ends on Monday, May 13th.
month. Go to Knix.com. That's KNIX.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing. Much of the mafia on screen involves clandestine meetings over linguine and red wine. I wanted to know if, just like Tony Soprano, Sammy frequented an Italian restaurant that felt like home.
Well, in Manhattan on Mulberry Street, I believe it's Angelo's. That was great. It was right on Mulberry Street. It was a great restaurant, great food, great service. And me, I stayed mostly in Brooklyn, Bensonhurst. I stayed in restaurants in places that really weren't all that fancy, but I went to them before I was anything, and I kind of stayed there, even though my rank or position, whatever you want to call it, increased.
But you like to eat.
Oh, I love to eat. You know, with Italians, everything is breaking bread. We talk, we eat. I mean, in my house with my father and them, you'd be at the table for an hour and a half. Not only would you eat the first meal, the antipasto, the pasta, this, that, when you were done, you're drinking a little wine, you're breaking the walnuts, or, you know, with the, and you're eating
the
nuts,
fruit,
stuff like that, and you conversed. It was a tie, a family tie, uniting the family and keeping it together, you know, and keeping it close. The kids would go off and run off and go play in the backyard. So it was not only a mafia thing, it was an Italian thing, basically. It was part of our roots.
On a tougher subject, the first time you killed somebody, and every time thereafter, was it always the same feeling, or was there a time when, you know, because a lot of it was at someone's direction. You were being ordered to do this. You were given a hit. You were given a job. Did you have to medicate yourself to get yourself in that state to do that job? Were you always in a natural state, or did you have to take a pill and take a couple of shots before you could do that?
First of all, a hit to me was always in order. I never did a hit without an order.
That you improvised, yeah.
So it always came from the top. You're not allowed to do it without, you know, permission anyway. But after the first hit, and I was into it, I became a very good hit guy. One of the reasons is that I was able to think. I was a thinker. I plan and plot a hit. I focus in, I'm going to use the word you, I'm not talking about you, but I focus in on you, on everything you did, every place you went. And I would disregard my family, my friends, my business, money. Nothing meant nothing to me other than you and where I was going to kill you. I became very, very efficient at it. And that's how I was used by bosses so many different times, because they knew that if I got your contract, you were finished. I never took drugs. The only thing I did as a kid when I smoked pot, but I never really took drugs. I never really drank. I didn't need any of that. And I thought that would be the worst thing you could do, because that'll fuck up how you think. And that's when you're going to make a mistake.
The podcast with Jim Carroll. Whose idea was that?
You know, when I got out of prison, I was going to write a second book. James Carroll came to me. He was going to do a documentary about me, and he had turned around and said, "Oh, wow, I'd love to work with you with this podcast." So I said, "All right." And I said, how do you think it'll... He says, "I heard, you know, you talk. If you could talk like that and on a podcast," he said, "you'll get 25 million hits. I started laughing. I had just got out of prison not too long ago. I said, I know I could get 10 people for sure, my ex-wife, my son, my daughter. I am not going to get 25 million people. I think as of today, we got 85 million views.
Oh my God.
So he was right.
You know, you're a very complicated guy. You know, one minute you take an omerta, an oath of silence. Now you got 85 million people listening to you on a podcast. You know what I mean? If Sammy Gravano then could see Sammy Gravano now, you'd be sitting there going, what the fuck is this? Hey, listen, thank you very much.
I thank you, too.
My thanks to Sammy Gravano and James Carroll. This episode was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.